Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Credit Card Cardholder Agreement Fine Print Edition. Today our featured guest is University of Notre Dame Professor of Law Amy Barrett, discussing Vaden v. Discover Bank, heard an oral argument on Monday, October 6th. Thanks for tuning in. In this case, the Supreme Court deals with the question of federal jurisdiction over state law arbitration obligations. The case arises from a dispute between Discover Bank and Discover cardholder Betty Vaden. When Mrs. Vaden filed class action counterclaims against Discover in response to their suit against her for nonpayment, Discover asked the federal district court to compel arbitration per the card member agreement. Mrs. Vaden appealed on the grounds that the district court did not have subject matter jurisdiction because the arbitration agreement was a matter of state law, but the Fourth Circuit looked through the petition to compel and found that the underlying dispute involved federal law, affirming the district court's decision to compel arbitration. The Supreme Court is now asked to decide whether such a suit brought under the Federal Arbitration Act, quote, arises under federal law when the petition to compel raises no federal question, but the underlying dispute does involve federal law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Barrett.
On Monday, October 6th, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Vaden v. Discover Bank. Daniel Ortiz, a professor at the University of Virginia Law School, argued for Betty Vaden, the petitioner. Carter Phillips of Sidley and Austin argued for Discover Bank and Discover Financial Services, the respondents. For simplicity's sake, I'm going to refer to Discover Bank and Discover Financial Services collectively as Discover. The facts of the case are relatively straightforward. Discover sued Vaden in Maryland State Court for nonpayment of a credit card balance in excess of $10,000. Vaden then filed class action claims against Discover for breach of contract and violation of Maryland state usury laws. After Vaden filed these counterclaims, Discover filed a petition in federal court under Section 4 of the Federal Arbitration Act seeking to compel arbitration of Vaden's state court counterclaims. Discover's petition raises complicated questions regarding the scope of federal jurisdiction under the Federal Arbitration Act. Section 4 of the Federal Arbitration Act authorizes aggrieved parties to petition to compel arbitration in, quote, any United States district court which, save for such agreement, would have jurisdiction under Title 28 of the subject matter of a suit arising out of the controversy between the parties, end quote. Arguing on behalf of the petitioner, Daniel Ortiz urged the court to adopt a narrow view of this language. According to Professor Ortiz, a district court can only exercise federal question jurisdiction under Section 4 if the arbitration agreement presents a federal question. Carter Phillips, arguing for the respondents, urged the court to take a broader view. According to Mr. Phillips, a district court can exercise federal question jurisdiction under Section 4 if the underlying dispute between the parties raises a federal question. At least on this threshold issue, the court seemed to think that Mr. Phillips had the better of the argument. Professor Ortiz argued that Section 4 has a narrow reach because it has a narrow purpose. It was designed to repudiate the so-called ouster doctrine, which had long barred specific performance of arbitration agreements. The statute instructs a district court to consider whether jurisdiction would exist, save for such agreement. According to Professor Ortiz, that language does not take the arbitration agreement wholly out of the jurisdictional equation. Instead, it instructs the district court to ignore the agreement's attempt to oust it of jurisdiction. Once the district court puts the ouster language aside, it must imagine whether it would have jurisdiction over the controversy between the parties. Professor Ortiz claimed that the controversy between the parties is the controversy about arbitrability. Consequently, he explained, federal question jurisdiction exists only if the obligation to arbitrate arises under federal law. The justices expressed skepticism about this argument. Chief Justice Roberts described it as a tough sell. Justice Souter told Professor Ortiz, "I have never understood this argument, and I don't understand it now." Justices Ginsburg, Scalia, and Stevens similarly suggested that Professor Ortiz was fighting against the language of the statute. Professor Ortiz's position is particularly difficult to maintain when considered in light of its consequences. His interpretation would render federal jurisdiction under Section 4 virtually non-existent. Very few federal statutes themselves create an obligation to arbitrate. Thus, federal question jurisdiction would rarely exist under Professor Ortiz's approach. It is also very difficult to see how diversity jurisdiction would ever exist if a district court were not permitted to look through the arbitration agreement to the underlying dispute. A court could make a judgment about complete diversity based on the face of the petition to compel. But because the arbitration agreement itself would rarely, if ever, satisfy the amount in controversy requirement, diversity jurisdiction would rarely, if ever, exist if a district court could not consider the amount in controversy in the underlying dispute. For that reason, even Professor Ortiz himself, somewhat paradoxically, was willing to concede that a district court could look through the arbitration agreement for the limited purpose of determining the amount in controversy. The court seemed much more inclined to adopt Mr. Phillips' proposed reading of the statute. According to Mr. Phillips, the command of Section 4 is straightforward. In making its jurisdictional determination, a district court is to set aside the arbitration agreement and ask whether it would have jurisdiction over the underlying controversy between the parties. Or, to use the language of the lower courts, Section 4 contemplates look-through jurisdiction. It instructs a district court to look through the arbitration request to assess whether the underlying dispute between the parties arises under federal law. While the justices seemed inclined to accept look-through jurisdiction, they seemed far less certain about what district courts should look at in determining whether jurisdiction exists. It was here that Mr. Phillips ran into difficulty with the court. Consider the posture of the suit pending in Maryland State Court between Discover and Vaden. Discover sued Vaden on state law contract claims. Vaden countered with state law usury claims, claims that Discover says are completely preempted by federal law. Assume that Discover is right about the complete preemption of Vaden's claims. Even so, the well-pleaded complaint rule, which, as every law student knows, is central to the court's interpretation of the federal question statute, would, in the normal course, prevent either Discover or Vaden from invoking federal jurisdiction. The well-pleaded complaint rule maintains that federal question jurisdiction cannot exist unless the federal question appears on the face of the plaintiff's well-pleaded complaint. Discover's complaint in the Maryland court, which sounded exclusively in state law, raised no federal question. Any federal question was raised in Vaden's counterclaim, and the court has expressly held that a federal counterclaim cannot serve as the basis for federal question jurisdiction. Thus, if Discover had tried to file initially in federal court, or if Vaden had tried to remove the suit to federal court, the well-pleaded complaint rule would have defeated those efforts. Mr. Phillips did not dispute that the well-pleaded complaint rule would operate to bar federal jurisdiction over this suit in the normal course. But he argued that the well-pleaded complaint rule does not apply to petitions to compel brought under Section 4 of the Federal Arbitration Act. That is so because Section 4 petitions can be filed even when there is no existing litigation. How can the well-pleaded complaint rule apply, Mr. Phillips argued, when Section 4 permits a petitioner to seek an order to compel arbitration even in the absence of any complaint? Before a complaint is filed, it is uncertain how a federal question might enter the case. For example, in this case, after receiving Discover's demand that she pay the balance due, Ms. Vaden might have initiated a suit in Maryland State Court claiming that a portion of the balance resulted from Discover's usurious rates. That claim, completely preempted by federal law, would have permitted a federal court to exercise federal question jurisdiction either as an initial matter or upon removal. True, that's not how the federal question actually entered the case here. But Mr. Phillips insisted that Discover should not be denied a federal forum merely because the shape of the suit had crystallized by the time it sought an order to compel. The fact that petitions can be filed in the absence of existing litigation compels the conclusion that the well-pleaded complaint rule is an opposite in the Section 4 context. Federal question jurisdiction should exist, Mr. Phillips urged, if there is a federal question lurking anywhere in the case. Here, as Vaden's counterclaim shows, there was a federal question lurking in the case. The justices were resistant to this broad view of jurisdiction. Justice Ginsburg observed that Mr. Phillips' look-through argument was in fact a look-through halfway argument. He wanted the court to ignore the assertion of the federal question as a counterclaim and to consider how the federal question could have entered the case. Chief Justice Roberts pointed out that a plaintiff gets to frame a complaint and can frame it in such a way as to avoid federal jurisdiction if she chooses. How, the Chief Justice inquired, should a judge go about deciding how the complaint should be framed? That would be particularly problematic in potential diversity cases, where a potential plaintiff would have the option of naming non-diverse parties or not. How should a district judge go about deciding whether to create or destroy complete diversity? Justice Scalia acidly observed that if a suit were not defined by the pleadings actually filed, jurisdiction would depend on whether the district judge could imagine a federal question being asserted somewhere in the suit. And it is close to inconceivable to me, Justice Scalia asserted, that Congress wanted us to construct litigation not yet in existence. The court was skeptical of the necessity of going to such lengths to preserve a party's ability to bring a petition to compel arbitration in a federal forum. Justice Souter criticized Mr. Phillips' tacit assumption that the respondent would be shortchanged on its arbitration right if it had to bring its arbitration claim in state court. The Federal Arbitration Act requires state courts to honor arbitration agreements, and there was no reason, Justice Souter insisted, to assume that they would not do so. Justice Breyer was the only member of the court who expressed some openness to Mr. Phillips' position. He acknowledged that Mr. Phillips' approach might cause difficulty in some cases, but that a judge applying it could easily find federal jurisdiction in the case actually before the court. But, as Justice Scalia retorted, accepting this theory in an easy case does not resolve the problem of what happens to the harder cases that arise down the line. Because of those harder cases down the line, it seems unlikely that the court will accept Mr. Phillips' permissive approach to look-through jurisdiction. It seems more likely that the court will seek some middle ground, an approach that would determine jurisdiction with reference to the underlying controversy, but not require a court to engage in the kind of imaginative exercise that Mr. Phillips proposed. One way for the court to cabin the look-through inquiry would be for it to hold that Section 4 does not displace the well-pleaded complaint rule. If its opponent has already filed a suit in state court that would satisfy the well-pleaded complaint rule, then, just as it could remove to federal court, the state court defendant could file a motion to compel arbitration in federal court. Alternatively, if no litigation has yet been filed, the Section 4 petitioner could make the necessary jurisdictional showing by demonstrating to the court that the petitioner itself could file a complaint satisfying the well-pleaded complaint rule. This approach would eliminate the need for the district judge to construct hypothetical litigation based on guesses about what the Section 4 petitioner's opponent might do. And in cases like Vaden versus Discover, where the Section 4 petitioner is unable to make either showing, the state courts remain open and able to enforce the Federal Arbitration Act's command that arbitration agreements be honored.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.